From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandy. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Carl Racine, the Attorney General of the District of Columbia. But joining us in studio now is Terry McAuliffe. He is the Governor of Virginia. Governor McAuliffe, thank you for joining us. Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Kojo, great to be back. Tom, great to be with you.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst, and he's also a columnist with the Current Newspapers and a reporter for NBC4. Tom Sherwood, as always, welcome. Governor McAuliffe, you should know that this day is Tom Sherwood's absolute favorite day of the year. Put on your headphones, and you will hear exactly why.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
That's it. Today, December 23rd, is Festivus. Tom Sherwood, you love Festivus.
It is spectacular. I actually did a Festivus in Adams Morgan on the street one year.
They're still celebrating it in Adams Morgan.
It's good. You know, I have a lot of problems with you people.
Tom Sherwood.
That's one of the great quotes.
His main grievance this year is the traffic in downtown Washington. He's very upset about this.
Governor, you just, I presume you didn't fly to the building in a helicopter. Did you just come through town? Well, this is a holiday week, so there's no traffic, right?
Actually, it was pretty light coming in from McLean, Virginia. I was actually surprised. We got here pretty quickly. We have no traffic in Virginia, as you know. It's all
stuck. That's right, because it doesn't move. You don't have any traffic because it doesn't move.
No, everyone's being industrious. They're working. They're with their families. They're low taxes. Everybody's very happy over there.
But when we air the grievances, Tom Sherwood's grievance this entire year has been the traffic in downtown Washington. Yeah. In previous years, it had been security barriers and stuff, but this year, traffic.
If I were to ever run for public office, transportation would be my number one issue. Because you can't have anything if you can't get there.
That's right.
Okay, for those of you who are celebrating Festivus,
running, so
happy Festivus. For those of you who'd like to join the conversation with Governor McAuliffe, you can call 800-433-8850. You can watch our live video stream and ask a question or make a comment at kojoshow.org. Send us email to kojo@wamu.org or a tweet at kojoshow. Tom Sherwood, the D.C. Council this week passed a paid leave bill that Mayor Muriel Bowser says that Governor McAuliffe in Virginia and Governor Hogan in Maryland should probably be happy about, because she said 66% of the beneficiaries of this new paid family leave will go to people who do not live in the District of Columbia. True or false?
Well, that's true, but it's also true that our minimum wage benefits people who live in the Maryland, Virginia suburbs and pay zero taxes to the District of Columbia. A larger issue about paid family leave is not that every person on the council and the mayor wants paid family leave, but this proposal the council has now approved, and if the mayor doesn't veto, would create a new D.C. government agency. It will tax any D.C. business 0.62% on payrolls. It will not benefit federal workers who live in the city and work for the, we can't do this to the federal government. Supporters say it's well overdue that the country is moving towards paid family leave like every other Western country in the world. But this, we have don't know yet, A, will the mayor veto it or allow it to go into effect without her signature?
She has already indicated that she doesn't plan on signing it, but has not indicated whether or not she will veto it.
Right. So we may have a little another fight over this in early January, or it just simply may become law. But then the city has to, it won't go into effect. Here's the key thing for people who are thinking about having a baby. It won't go into effect until 2020, late 2019 or 2020, because they've got to write the regulations, impose the tax, collect the money, create the agency, and then we could have it. So it may be some time.
Well,
before.
I'm going to put off having my baby until 2020. But Governor McAuliffe, how do you feel about paid family leave?
Oh, I support paid family leave. And listen, D.C. is going to do what they're going to do. In Virginia, listen, we're working on our economy. We're working on transportation. We're working on our education. Kojo, we've had a great year. I mean, you look what we've been able to accomplish in Virginia this year. Just take transportation. Tom was talking about that. 66 inside, outside the Beltway. I just negotiated a deal. $2.1 billion, not a penny of Virginia taxpayer money will be used, all paid for by outside groups. It's about a $2.5 billion swing for the Virginia taxpayers. We're beginning construction inside 66. I just announced the Atlantic Gateway Project, $1.4 billion. New bridge over the Rappahannock River. We're adding express lanes all the way to the D.C. border, and then we're taking them 10 miles south past Fredericksburg. So as it relates to transportation, we literally have everything all firing on all cylinders, billions of dollars of projects going. You know, you're right, though, Tom. If you can't move people around, you know, people will go elsewhere. It's a quality of life issue in addition.
You can't build your way out of the traffic issues. The mayor was, Mayor Bowser was on this show last week, and I talked to her about my favorite subject, traffic. And she said that's another reason why Metro itself has to get better, because this region has to move people more efficiently, and Metro is there. It just has to be fixed. What are you expecting with President-elect Trump coming in? We need more federal support for Metro. We need more support from Virginia, which won't agree to a stable funding program. What's going to happen with Metro?
Well, first of all, we're working very closely with Paul Wiedefeld. I think he's doing an excellent job.
The general manager.
Yep, the general manager. For a year, I was raising heck about the board not being able to get a general manager in there. We went for a year, way too long, but he's in there. He's doing a great job. In fact, yesterday was great news. As you know, we got taken off the restricted list, as you know, from the federal government to get approval for spending. That was a big win. Let me congratulate Paul and all the folks. That was a great win for us yesterday for Metro. I'm a huge supporter of it. What Paul has said to my Secretary of Transportation, Aubrey Lane, and my team, we're going to come up. We're going to get you the numbers you need to know. But what they came out at the end of November, as you know, is they want to spend about a $1.25 billion in capital just in 18. They want to spend about $7 billion more over the next 6 years, which is $1 billion more, Tom, than their original plan, as you know. This is really serious money. We need a plan. I can't go, obviously, to my legislature and others until we have a very specific plan how the money will be used. You would do this in business. But we're all going to get there. I support it. We need some dedicated funding. Couldn't agree more. It's a little trickier for Virginia. I only have one vote. As you know, Arlington, Alexandria, and Fairfax have their own votes on it. But we're going to come together. Couldn't agree more. Silver Line, just look at Tyson's Corner today. Just look at the development going on there today.
Well, you know, I wish success. I hope to be able to ride Metro again.
Yes, Tom has been.
And you
got
to ride it when you get on when you're supposed to get on it, and you get off when you're supposed to get off.
Right.
And you know you're safe. That's, I mean, this is all
pretty much a crapshoot if you go on the Metro train now. You don't know whether you're going to get off on time or not.
Yeah.
I'd rather bet over there at the casino.
One of the conflict of interest concerns about the new incoming Trump administration does center on your state, Virginia. The president-elect is allowing his vineyard there to apply for special temporary visas for foreign workers. Conflict of interest or appearance of conflict of interest? How do you see it?
Well, I think appearance. I think, listen, I wish the president-elect would put everything he had into a blind trust. I did that when I got elected governor. I think everybody in elected office ought to just go ahead and do it. It takes all the issues away. Why does he need these kinds of issues? And he does have a very large winery. You know, it used to be where Thomas Jefferson used to ride horses. It is a major winery. Listen, I want to work closely with the new president. He has said he wants defense spending. If we can work together and get sequestration off the table for this region, for Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, we're the number one recipient of Department of Defense dollars. If we can get rid of sequestration, which happens next October, you know, cost us $9.8 billion 2011 through 13 just in Virginia. He wants to put $1 trillion into infrastructure and all these different projects. Let's go. We're willing to work with them on all these big projects.
On a big issue for me, are you going to be here for the inauguration?
I will be in Richmond on Inauguration Day. I have some events I'm doing. And fair, you know, I also serve as chairman now of all the governors. I'm the chairman of the National Governors Association. And all 50 governors, we all get invited to the inaugural.
But you won't. You'll be in Richmond.
I'll be in Richmond.
You know, a lot of people, we're going to have a huge crowd here, those who are coming to support and praise and have hope for the new president. We have an unknown number of protesters who are coming. Some may leech over into suburban Virginia.
Yep.
Are you at all concerned about the inauguration and public safety surrounding it? And
sure.
People just getting in on Metro for it?
Well, we work very closely with all the different jurisdictions. I mean, I know this very well. I chaired Bill Clinton's inaugural in 1996, and I can tell you this is a massive effort to put on one of these inaugurals. You'll probably have protests, but, I mean, that's all part of democracy. You remember 2000, Tom, on Pennsylvania Ave after the whole Florida incident with Bush v. Gore. But it'll be safe. The city will look great. The region will look great. state, and a lot of activity going on out there.
Have you been to the new Trump Hotel yet?
I have not.
On your agenda?
If I get invited to something, I'll go. Listen, I've said this before. I've known Donald Trump for 20 years. He actually wrote me a check when I ran in 2009. Yeah. I've golfed with him. I had dinner with him. I know him. I'm hoping to be able to work with that relationship. I got to get things done as governor. I got to grow the economy, get rid of sequestration, put some infrastructure dollars into Virginia. And we're, and as I say, on behalf of all the governors, this is what we want. We want to get these defense cuts out, off the table. We want to have more infrastructure spending. So, you know, as governor, I'll work with anyone if you want to work with me to help me grow the economy in Virginia.
Well, Hillary Clinton is a longtime friend of yours. Yep. Her running mate was Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. Yep. Everybody in your camp predicted a Hillary win. How do you shake that off? What did that election mean for you personally?
Well, it meant a lot to me personally. I've known the Clintons for 38 years. We've been great family friends. We've spent many vacations together. It was heartbreaking. And I think you're right, Kojo. I think every poll pretty much had it wrong. I wish almost she'd been down and you just wouldn't feel as bad. I mean, I think it was shocking for everybody. So personally, and you know, I've spent a lot of time talking to the Clinton family since Election Day. It's heartbreaking. But as I say, you got to get up the next day and you got to get back at it. People elected me to serve as governor. So I sent a letter to President-elect Trump the next day. Let's work together on defense. Let's work together on infrastructure. You know, I'm the ultimate optimist, and you got to move forward and you got to get back on that saddle again. Just like when I got thrown off an Africa a couple of years ago and shattered seven ribs, you got to get back on that horse and you got to keep on moving.
Our guest is Terry McAuliffe. He is the governor of Virginia. If you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850. This past spring, you restored the voting rights to some 200,000 felons in a sweeping executive order, not without legal pushback, which required your office to individually restore those rights. We have what may be a related question from Jim in Springfield, Virginia. Put on your headphones, please. Jim, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Governor. It's indeed a pleasure to be able to talk to you and the esteemed announcer, Kojo. I worked for your campaign. I love what you've done. You're just part of the new Virginia. I'm so proud to be a part of it.
Thank you.
The guy that came up to work in the Fed government and retired. I'm an old white male.
Okay.
Welcome to the club.
Tom and I are there, too.
Forgive my long lead-in, but anyway, I just have three short things I'd like to say. One, I hope you can use – you've done well, wonderful for our economic side of Virginia, I'll tell you that. The three things I hope you can do for the remainder of your administration, I hope you can continue to use your power of pardon and clemency to try to bring some justice to our flawed prison system. There are just disproportionately too many people that.
Okay, you got two more, Jim, and you got 30 seconds.
The other one is keep doing what you can to save the environment for our wonderful tourism industry here in Virginia. Yeah. And
the third?
The third, I'll help you whatever you do if you want to continue running for public office.
All right, thank you.
Good response.
Well, thank you, Jim. Appreciate that. Yeah, the economy, $14.23 billion since I've been governor. We're very proud of that. That's about $5 billion more than any governor in the history of the Commonwealth. I got a year to go. We got a lot of big projects lined up. Our big issue in Virginia, it's not that we don't have high-paying jobs. We got to build the skill set to match the jobs that exist today. I have close to 150,000 high-tech jobs open right now in Virginia. I got to fill those. That's why I put $1 billion into education last year to transform our high schools, getting skills so that when they get out, they can go right into the workforce. Number two, thanks on the restoration of rights. I think we're close to getting up to 160,000 done. Right thing to do. 40 states had already done that, and I will continue to do that. I did a pardon yesterday for him. He's right in Virginia. You know, it's $200 as a felony in Virginia. So if you take an iPhone, you are convicted of a felony. I've tried for 3 years to raise that limit. We're putting too many people away. I spend $28,000 per prisoner per year. People should be on community service. We should have more drug courts. They should be in rehab. They should not be in prison. But we have reformed our juvenile justice system, and we're fighting hard on the environment. And we just won a major grant on sea level rise and resiliency. So we're leading on these big issues. Solar We've gone from 18 megawatts of solar to 400 megawatts, $500 million investment for clean energy when I became governor. It's over $2 billion today, so we're moving in the right direction.
Does your staff spend all this time getting these statistics for you? You can't. You've already given us a zillion statistics.
Well, Tom, I'm sure you go to Governor Dodd, Virginia, every single day.
And you
see
all these things.
It's a rolling ticker every single day.
Let's go back to politics for a moment.
Sir.
Not that anything you haven't said in politics.
Yep.
The Democratic National Committee. Tim Kaine, the senator, was a chairman of the chair of the committee. There's a big fight going on
now. And so was I.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Yeah,
excuse me.
I didn't.
You've had so many.
A lot of titles.
Okay, here's the deal. You're not going to have a president in the White House.
Yep.
The party's got to pick somebody to lead the party.
Yep.
The Democrats are in bad shape at the city, county, and state, and now national level, Congress and the White House. Where are you on getting someone to head the DNC to start moving the national party back in another direction?
I know where he is because we got a tweet from Lowell asking about the governor's support for Tom Perez for DNC chair and an email from Boyd on the same topic. Doesn't your close association with the Clintons make this more of a proxy contest between the Clinton and Sanders wings of the party? How will the candidate you support reach out to the progressive wing of the
party? Keith Ellison from Minnesota, I believe.
He is also a candidate.
He's a candidate. Where are you and what should people expect?
So four of us endorsed yesterday. Myself, Gina Raimondo, the governor of Rhode Island. We had the governor Hickenlooper of Colorado and John Bel Edwards, the governor of Louisiana, endorsed Tom Perez. It has nothing to do with Clinton versus Sanders. I have known Tom Perez for 20 years.
And he's a local guy.
He's a local guy, Virginia issues.
Former Montgomery County.
He worked very closely with me when he was Secretary of Labor. Last year, he came to Virginia and did the JJ speech for me as a favor to me. He is a progressive. And I called Keith Ellison yesterday. I had a great call with him yesterday. He said, I know you've known him. Personal relationships are important. And I said, Keith, if you win this thing, let me tell you this, I will host the first event for you. So to me, it's not personal. It's about I have a long-standing relationship with Tom Perez. I think he'll be a dynamite leader. He's a great progressive. He will move the party forward. But
what do you need to do, though? I mean, whoever gets that job, there's a lot of work, it seems to me, for the Democrats to overcome. But it's now a very heavy Republican majority. What will that person do?
First of all, just say at the top. We should always say it. Hillary did get 3 million more votes for president from the popular vote, but obviously you don't get elected. You go through the Electoral College. But you hit on a very good point. You look at the gains they have made in the last decade on state legislative chambers, state legislative seats, members of Congress, both the House and the Senate. We are down to 16 Democratic governors today. We have been obliterated. Couldn't agree with you more. I'm leading an effort in trying to get folks to understand we have 36 governors up, Tom, in 2018. If we don't win those governors, what will happen with the 2020 census that will happen when they redistrict in 2021? The chambers will draw the legislative districts. Most of the chambers, a vast majority, are now Republican chambers. There's only one way you can stop that, is to have a Democratic governor sitting there to veto that redistricting map. If we are not successful in 2018, our party will be out for a decade.
And then you, of course, have the Virginia race for governor this year.
Next year, 17. Ralph Northam, we don't have a primary on our side. They have a hefty primary on theirs. You know, in Virginia for 44 straight years, I broke the curse, but for 44 straight years, whatever party won the White House the next year, the other party won the governor's mansion. I hope we go back to that and get that back for Ralph.
Here now is Isaac in Fairfax, Virginia. Isaac, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Governor. Thank you, Isaac, for your high-tech initiative in Virginia.
Yep.
Maybe could you take just 1 minute to really elucidate about it? And the one suggestion I want to give you is there are baby boomers like us who want to move into high-tech, but what is lacking is not the training, but getting the training and then getting some kind of internship or mentorship. So one of the things I like to suggest is you consider in your IT development project to figure out how we can get a mentorship or an internship after getting the training with companies around here. Thank you very much.
Governor McAuliffe.
No, it's a good point. But first of all, let me just say, training is important. We've got to change our education system. I have right now 36,000 jobs open in Virginia in the cybersecurity space. The starting pay is $88,000. That's about $3.25 billion of annual payroll wages. It's worth about $157 million to me for our state budget that would go toward our budget. So we've got our high schools don't work in America anymore. They're big buildings with classroom, with seats. You get credit for seat time. We need to be matching all these jobs so that's why I've started all these cyber camps in Virginia over the summer. While you're in high school, you can go to a 9-week cyber course. So you begin to get interested. You ought to know about these things instead of waiting for your guidance counselor junior, senior year in high school. You ought to know when you are in K through 12. These are the jobs that are going to exist in the future. But we also, going to his point, we do apprenticeships. We do internships. I've just done something we've done in Virginia no other state has done. We know what industry credentials are needed today. I'll pay 2/3 of the cost for you to get that industry credential in Virginia. If you're willing to go get it, you put up a third, I'll put, and you need to have some skin in the game, but you put up a third, I'll put up 2/3. Let's just take truck drivers very quickly. We have 46,000 truck driving jobs open in America today. Starting pay is $45,000. I can send you to a 6-week course in Southwest Virginia. I'll pay 2/3 of that cost, about $1,200. You put $600. I can get you right working.
How does someone who wants that job, what agency can connect with the state government? Where do you go to get
connected? Well, you go, we have a whole workforce development on our website through our Department of Commerce and Workforce Development. We have all of this listed, but we are really trying to change the way we deliver education. We're trying to lead the nation on this. It's very important. We have a whole program I just announced for veterans. When the veterans come back, remember, I'm very proud. I was the first and only state to be certified to have ended veteran homelessness in our state. That was a big honor for Virginia. We have 800,000 veterans. We love our military in Virginia, but now we have a program. We can work you right through, get you that cyber credential, and get you right into the workforce. That's how you build what I call the new Virginia economy. Forget, it's a new economy. It's a disruptive economy. It's different. You got to lead.
Virginia's voter ID law was upheld in a federal appeals court last week, while just a few months ago, North Carolina's was struck down. What, in your view, is the difference between Virginia's and North Carolina's laws, and will this be appealed again?
Well, you know, I'm not the appellant. We'll have to figure out if they'll appeal. They'll make that decision. I was disappointed in the ruling. Kojo, what has gone on systematically around the country, and this has been a concerted effort to roll back voting rights around the country. This is what has happened with many of these chambers, Tom, we were just talking about. To make it harder for people to vote. Listen, growing up, you and I growing up, you'd walk in that polling booth, you'd give your name, you'd go in and vote. Maybe you used a utility bill or whatever, and there wasn't any massive fraud. This is all made up about this massive fraud. They've made it harder for people to vote. We ought to make it easier for people to vote. The one thing bothers me about the last presidential election, 95 million Americans stayed home. True. And, you know, we had a bunch of protesters after the election, protesting Trump's election. About 12 of them, I think 4 or 5 of them in Richmond were arrested. You know what we found out?
They hadn't voted.
That's, and I said issue. On the TV, you have no right to protest. If you didn't take the time, our men and women in military uniform are around this globe protecting this right, and you can't take the time to go vote, well, then you have no right to protest. I'm sorry. You got to be kidding me.
And speaking of North Carolina, we got a tweet from Hef who says, what does the governor think about what's going on in North Carolina and how it can be prevented elsewhere like Virginia? I presume that Hef is referring to the North Carolina state legislature's refusal to repeal the law that insists that people have to go to the bathroom, use the bathroom that's on their, of the gender that's on their birth certificate.
Yeah. I think he's referring to two things. Number one, it was just a freak show down there this week. I mean, it was just, it made the state look, you know, listen, North Carolina, historic, a great progressive state. They have gone so far backwards. I mean, I hate to say this. It's a newer to our benefit. It's a newer to other states' benefit. We just got CoStar to move to Richmond, Virginia, 700-plus high-paying jobs. They were going to North Carolina. North Carolina offered them 3 times the incentives that we offered. They came to Richmond because of the HB2. But the other thing I think they're mentioning, Kojo, I don't know if you've seen what the legislature and the governor have done. It was a very close rate, went to a recount. They have stripped the governor, the new incoming Democratic governor, of many of his rights and authorities. And the outgoing governor signed this legislation from an extreme right-wing legislature. I'm telling you what is going on. People have got to learn to work together. I work very closely. It's a very Republican legislature in Richmond. But you know what? We work together on the economic development issues. We differ on social issues. But we come together for the good of Virginia. And what's happening in North Carolina today is an embarrassment and a shame for that great state.
The progressives in your party really do need to figure out how to talk. I think Diane Reamon, her closing program today, signing off after 37 years, said that people in the media should listen better to people, whether we personally agree with them or not. Seems to me the middle of the country, the Democrats don't even speak to those folks.
And we've got a great message, but you got to be out there. You got to show up. I think I think what was tapped into this election, Tom, also is this income inequality. I think they saw the top 1, 2% doing very well. People felt that, you know, my own personal existence hadn't gotten any better.
Right.
And everything's become such a hassle. You know, I just had Verizon out to my house for the 15th time in 2 months. Everything, and I don't mean to pick on Verizon, but everything is a hassle. Get it right. Do it right. They want government to function for you. And they're sick and tired of having to go over and over. And I just think people have reached a boiling point.
Do you think President Trump is draining the swamp in Washington and is going to address all those issues of people's and their boiling point?
No, I think it's going to be the same old, you know, he's going to put people in or going to lobby and do whatever they're going to do. But, you know, I mean, we'll see where he is on Obamacare. We'll see what he does. He's already backtracked a little bit on that. And
Danielle wants us to see where he is on teachers. Here's Danielle in Winchester, Virginia. Danielle, go ahead, please.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. And I participated in one of your cyber camps this summer at John Hanley High School, and it was a fantastic experience.
Good.
So I appreciated your commitment to that. But I think one area that Virginia lags somewhat behind as a right-to-work state is teacher salaries. So I was wondering your plans to attract and retain quality teachers, because to me that's, as an educator, it's important to have a wage that I can support my family on. And as of right now, teacher salaries are often lacking. So where do you see Virginia headed in terms of teacher salaries and attracting and retaining quality teachers?
Well, and you're right, Danielle. For years, I think going back to 07, the pre-recession, I mean, teachers hadn't had a pay raise or state employees had a pay raise. You know, since I've been governor, I've done two pay raises. In addition, we wanted to do another 3%, but the budget doesn't allow us to do it. So I just came out the other day and announced that I'll do a 1.5 bonus for December 1, 2017. It costs me cost the state about $130 million to do that. All of our state employees, all of our teachers were bonusing. And listen, I'd love to get it where we can continue to get pay raises. Our economy is getting better. November, we had a great month. We were up 13.4%. We're up about 5.4% for the year, you know, looking at a 2.7 budget. And, you know, every point you go up is worth about $188 million. So, you know, I'm the ultimate optimist. I'm cautiously optimistic. But, you know, listen, we got to have a balanced budget. We've got to have a fiscally sound budget, which we do. You know, we've got the AAA rating from all of the credit agencies. We're very proud of that. But you're right, Daniel. Teachers are number one. They're going to go to other states if people offer them more money. But as I say, since I've been in office, I've continued to do raises and bonuses, and I'll continue to do what I can to make sure our teachers are competitive. We have the best teachers in the world. I live in governor of the greatest state in the greatest nation on earth, Commonwealth of Virginia.
You have suggested taxes for online sales. We got an email from Robin in Arlington who says, I tried to sell LPs on eBay. Between how few actually sell, acquisition costs, and eBay fees, I net substantially less than minimum wage. If I have to track and pay sales taxes on top of everything else, the time and costs involved will simply put me out of business. How would you respond to Robin?
Well, first of all, the Marketplace Fairness Act, which is in Congress today. Now, as chairman of the NGA, I've gone personally, spoken to Speaker Ron, Leader Mitch McConnell, all the governors. We all support this. I mean, this is a tax you're supposed to pay today. This is not a new tax. You're required to pay it today. Now, if you don't put it on your tax form, that's your business. But we lose $250 to $300 million a year. I got to tell you, I used to own a shopping center. I've been in the business. I paid for brick, mortar, glass. It is very hard for me to compete when someone just gets on online, buys it. And I go to my house in McLean today. There's 10 boxes from Amazon there. My wife is gone. She's out. You know, whatever. I hope she's paying taxes. I'm not sure of that. My point is, it is competitively fair. It's a fairness issue, and it's also tax money. It's already due today. This is not a new tax.
I don't understand why people think they shouldn't have to pay sales tax on purchases.
Right.
They don't. They go to, well, of course, in the district, we don't pay sales tax on groceries, unlike Virginia.
Yeah.
But people go and they buy something at a Macy's or wherever. They pay the sales tax. I'm not sure
it's
where the idea came that, well, I can buy it online. It doesn't cost anything.
Yeah.
It's like getting newspapers for free.
Yep.
And other services for free. Everything is free online. Yep. Well, somebody's paying for
it. I mean, these little mom-and-pop stores, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I had to buy some wine. I got a big old party tonight. We're going to have some fun. I went to the little, in McLean, the little wine shop. You got to support those local mom-and-pop stores, or they're not going to be around anymore because everyone's going to be buying online. It's fairness.
Joining us in studio now is Carl Racine. He is the Attorney General of the District of Columbia. This is our gimmick so that we can get Governor McAuliffe to leave the studio. Otherwise, he will absolutely never leave the studio.
You guys know each other?
The studio.
We do.
Greatest Attorney General in D.C. history.
Well, I would say that that's very kind of you, Mr. Governor. Your Attorney General, Mark Herring, is an outstanding Attorney General.
Yes.
He's taken.
There's too much love here.
He's
this is festive. Let's try to start.
Let me ask.
The Federal Transit Administration announced
that
they'll
return. The Redskins.
I wanted to talk about Metro again.
Are you done with me?
No.
Metro's general manager this week requested an additional $1 billion over the next 3 years from the three jurisdictions Metro serves. We talked with your transportation secretary, Aubrey Lane, about it earlier this week. We know the Commonwealth is facing a budget shortfall. Are there alternatives for funding Metro, and will Virginia help foot the bill?
Of course we're going to help. As I said earlier, Kojo, it's three jurisdictions and the state. I have one vote, Arlington, Alexander, and Fairfax. We all have to come to the table. Let me be very clear. We are all going to do what we have to do. We all love Metro. We're going to make sure it works. All we're asking for is a strategic financial plan. As I just went through the numbers, they're asking for $1.25 billion in fiscal year 18. That is a large amount of money. And over the next 6 years, as I mentioned, they're asking for $7 billion. Before I go to my legislature, how are we going to spend the $7 billion? That's capital. That's not operating. That is just new capital. And listen, I understand it, but I need a comprehensive plan to go to my legislature.
The mayor of the District of Columbia has suggested, Tom, a sales tax, right? For
a 1% regional sales tax. Mr. Attorney General, Mr. Racine, have you gotten involved in any of these Metro funding discussions? I know that the CFO has, but this is crucial to the city's economy.
It is critical to the city's economy. My involvement is not on a policy basis. I did see the CFO and listen to his presentation, very thoughtful, very thorough, and the costs that we are about to incur are staggering. And I think the governor is exactly right. Metro needs to give a clear plan about the way forward so that we can make the educated decision to get the funding that it needs.
All right, we weren't able to start a fight here.
Wait, no, can I do one real quick?
Oh, yeah, sure.
The governor, Mr. Racine, I don't believe you've ever, to my knowledge, I checked, I couldn't find where you publicly said whether or not you think the Washington Redskins should be allowed to come back to town and build a new, at its cost, a stadium at the site of old RFK at its cost. And I'm just wondering where you are, because, you know, the Governor McAuliffe is trying to get the team out of Maryland back into Virginia. Where are you on that? Because, you know, people think you might want to run for mayor. This would be a big issue for you if you ran for mayor.
Well, leaving that that second part aside, I've listened to the governor's arguments, and I've listened to my mayor, Mayor Bowser's arguments, and I think Mayor Bowser has the better of the argument. The Washington Redskins should be in the District of Columbia, and we should compete forcefully with our colleague here to my right and get the Skins back to D.C.
And final word for you, Governor McAuliffe. You want them in Virginia.
Yeah, listen, at the end of the day, if we can structure a deal, we are 8.5 million people in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I think D.C.'s 680. They're a nice suburb of Virginia. But at the end of the day, a vast majority of the season ticket holders, every player lives in Virginia. Their headquarters is in Virginia. Their training camp is in Virginia. So, you know, I just think we got to do what's right for the future. I'm worried about Dan Snyder's economic future, so I'm trying to help him. And I'll say goodbye. I'm going to have lunch right now. Standing right, the new mayor of Richmond, Virginia, LeVar Stoney, youngest mayor of a big city in America, 35 years old. It's a new day.
And who's the young guy hanging out with you?
And that's my son Jack just back.
Who's buying?
Hey, happy holidays.
Where are you going for lunch? Can you
Jack's
tell us?
Jack's probably going to be forced to pick up the tab.
Are you kidding me? This,
happy holidays.
This train keeps going. Merry Christmas, everybody.
If you have questions or comments for Carl Racine, the Attorney General of the District of Columbia, give us a call now, 800-433-8850. Send email to Kojo at WAMU.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or you can simply go to our website, KojoShow.org, and join the conversations there. Republicans will have a solid majority in both houses as well as the White House. What will that mean, Carl Racine, for district autonomy, especially when it comes to progressive legislation that the district has passed, including the legalization of recreational marijuana, gun laws, and budget autonomy? We got an email from Josh to that. Essentially, that question is the result.
Josh is the leader of the statehood, one of the leaders of the statehood.
Yes. Yeah.
I think what it means for the District of Columbia and the elected officials, as well as the residents of D.C., is that we have to make it clear that D.C. follows the most important principles that Republicans follow: federalism, local governmental control. We need to defend our local laws, and I can tell you that the Office of Attorney General will be ready to do its best in court, if necessary, to protect the District of Columbia.
Do you have, you know, this is all about politics. You know, I said the other day at the Federal City Council, I'm not clear that the mayor's office has an aggressive effort up on Capitol Hill. She has an office. She helped create one to make sure that if somebody's up there. But do you have ties to Capitol Hill where you can head off things before you have to start thinking legal issues? Seems to me the city doesn't have an advocacy group really working both the House and the Senate up there.
I was at the lunch at the Federal City Council that you presided over. And the reality is that Mayor Bowser did establish the first office in a mayor's office that would liaison with the Capitol. It's clear that we all need to, I think, be far more strategic and collaborative in order to have a more powerful voice and really make friends at Congress. We can be friends with Republicans. Many Republicans believe in the principle that local people should be able to pass the laws that they believe in. And I think that with the mayor's leadership and other elected officials, we could surprise folks by really striking alliances that will respect local D.C. laws.
A D.C. government employee recently filed a $10 million whistleblower lawsuit alleging he was terminated because he would not follow politically motivated pressure in the awarding of a major construction contract. How is the city handling that case? You've talked about ensuring good government and ending corruption and the perception of corruption. Don't cases like this feed that perception?
They really do, Kojo. And you're talking about a lawsuit filed by two former employees of the Department of Government Services. They make allegations that they were fired because they didn't support the award of two significant contracts to donors of elected officials. We're defending those lawsuits, so I can't really talk too much about the legal strategy there. But your point is well taken. What we need to do is go ahead and bite the bullet and pass comprehensive campaign finance laws that would include a bar that donors who contribute cannot get contracts from the District of Columbia. That would go a long way in removing the appearance of impropriety that still dogs the District of Columbia.
There's an older case involving Eric Payne, and again, you're constrained as what you can and cannot say. But a court has ruled that Eric Payne was improperly dismissed and should be awarded $1.7 million because he did not follow political instructions on the city's controversial lottery contract some years ago before the current administration. It's up to you to decide whether to work that out and to pay him or to challenge that decision. Can you tell us where you are in the process for that? Some people think he's been terribly mistreated. Others say that this is just a very bad case, that he's really not entitled to the money.
Sure.
Except that he did win the case.
He won the case at trial, and the jury did, in fact, award him $1.7 million with respect to emotional distress. We are defending the city as we are obligated to at the Attorney General's office. Right now, we filed motions just the other day seeking to reduce aspects of that award. I'm looking forward to getting together with Mr. Payne and Donald Temple, his lawyer, and my friend, sitting down and really trying to resolve this matter in a way that's fair to Mr. Payne and fair to the District of Columbia.
You can negotiate a smaller amount, and if he were to accept it, that would be all right.
I think there is a fair settlement out there that would be acceptable to the district and to Mr. Payne.
Speaking of being fair, can I ask about the mayor's office?
Again, sure.
I'm going to. I look at Kojo when I want to ask something, and then I don't wait for him to respond.
Sometimes I have to leap across the table and gag him.
We're into 2017 within a matter of days. People who are going to run for mayor in 2018 are not going to wait probably until 2018. Mayor Muriel Bowser started in March, a full year and a half before the election. You're constantly being mentioned as a possible candidate for mayor. I did it this week in my little newspaper column. You've never given a definitive answer about where that fits on your schedule of whether you're thinking about it, you might think about it, or you're fixing to get ready to start thinking about it, you're not going to do it. Can you give us, as we start going forward, because you're working with the mayor on a lot of things, crime issues,
absolutely,
and prosecution. I know all the good stuff. I'm thinking of the politics. Where are you when people come up to you and say, you ought to run for mayor? Where are you in saying yes, no, or maybe?
Sure. Here's where I'm at. Number one, I haven't decided whether I would run again for AG or any other office or simply return to the private sector. Number two, I don't really have an established time frame to make a decision. I'm just 2 years into this job. I'm not a career politician, so I don't really think about what's the next office. That's not my thinking. My thinking is really focused on how to build a strong, independent attorney general's office. Nonetheless, you can be assured that I'll be making important decisions related to whether to run again in the next 6 months, and you'll be the first to know.
I doubt it.
The Washington Post recently published a series of articles about the Youth Rehabilitation Act, a program aimed at giving young offenders a second chance, but it's apparently led to some horrific crimes. Do you think the Youth Rehabilitation Act needs to be reformed? And if so, how?
Well, I think the articles that the Post published really brought to light some very, very significant problems. Problems first in regards to information that the public should have about the outcomes of these Youth Rehabilitation Act sentences. The Post was able to uncover many instances where individuals got the benefit of the act and then committed more crime, in many cases, more violent crime. We also need to know about the successes under the act. In addition, we need to also understand what type of services are these young men and women beneficiaries of the act getting. I'm working really hard now. I know the mayor is focused on this issue as well. I anticipate that with Charles Allen and Kenyon McDuffie, my friends on the Judiciary Committee, we're going to take a hard look at the act and make sure that there's more transparency, accountability, and if there needs to be refinements, you can look for my office to take the lead in drafting legislation on that.
That's a very interesting Post series, but it did point out that one of the problems in assessing how good the program is or how bad it might be is that if someone is charged and gets a sentence under the Youth Rehabilitation Act and they don't commit any future crimes, their record is wiped out, and there's no real good record of the people who have benefited from the program. Is there going to be a way to get that information? Because this might be, all these cases that they cite are horrific in many cases, but we don't know the person who went through the system and now is leading a productive life.
No, that's exactly right. There was a letter to the editor of the Washington Post earlier this week where an individual who benefited from the act wrote about his experience, and he has not committed other crimes since being a beneficiary. But this is the kind of information the public deserves. As you know, the Office of Attorney General has exclusive jurisdiction for the prosecution of juveniles. We, in fact, do not play a role in regards to the adult prosecutions that lead to Youth Act sentences.
That's the U.S. Attorney.
That's correct. The U.S. Attorney does that. What we do, however, do in the juvenile justice realm is we partner with the Department of Human Services in D.C., and we created a robust diversion program. Over 900 young juveniles who have been involved in low-level nonviolent offenders have gone through this program. We keep copious records and details, and that's why we're able to report that over 80% of this 900 have not been rearrested after receiving very intensive services. That's the kind of information the public deserves to get from Youth Act sentences as well.
There was another big political and policy issue this year, September, I think, when you and the mayor and attorney, U.S. Attorney Channing Phillips, agreed that your office would work with the U.S. Attorney's Office and do more prosecutions to free up U.S. Attorney lawyers to do more of the more serious crimes. Has that even started? Because I know there had to be Justice Department had to have approval for this. Has that even happened? Has the program started? Have you exchanged lawyers? Where are we in that?
Here's where we are. And I think it was a very, very strategic and clever idea to free up the U.S. attorneys so they can focus on the violent crime and at the same time allow the Office of Attorney General lawyers to begin prosecuting those federal offenses and the D.C. local offenses that the U.S. Attorney's Office tries. Right now, we're in the process of hiring the 8 prosecutors for the job, and I can tell you that we've received hundreds of extraordinary resumes. I believe in January, and we'll report this out, we will have hired all 8 of the new prosecutors. And then again, importantly, we're going to keep very close records on what work they do, what the results have been, because we'd like to make the case that the Office of Attorney General should be the prosecutor not only of juvenile offenses in the District of Columbia, but also of adult offenses.
But we're about to have a change in administration, so there's going to be a new Justice Department Attorney General. Won't be the one we have now. Has the Justice Department signed off yet?
You know, there's uncertainty as to whether...
That sounds like no.
Actually, let me back up. The Justice Department has signed off on it. Under Loretta Lynch, the appropriate folks have given the approval. And of course, the U.S. Attorney Channing Phillips has been a strong advocate of more local prosecutions from the Office of Attorney General. The question is, will the new Justice Department continue to support the agreement? I'm optimistic that the tradition of U.S. attorneys in the District of Columbia to work very closely with the local prosecutors will continue, and I'm looking forward to working with the new U.S. attorney.
All MPD officers are now equipped with body cameras, but less clear are the rules around viewing that footage. Can you talk about that and what the issues are around the media and the public viewing of footage of incidents?
Sure. As you noted, just about every Metropolitan Police Department officer on the street now has a body cam video. The rules of the road are essentially this. The Metropolitan Police Department is the authority for release of body cam videos. They can do it in an emergency situation where there's been a police-involved shooting, or they can do it pursuant to the statute when an individual or the press request an opportunity to view the footage.
And the mayor can direct it.
The mayor can direct it in those exigent circumstances where there's a public interest in disclosing the video. There is an ambiguity, and I know that my friend Paul Wagner from Fox News isn't happy with me on this. There are occasions where our office uses body cam video in evidence in trials. What Paul Wagner would like to have are those copies, the actual copies of the evidence that we present at trial. Yes,
several news organizations would like that.
And it's my reading of the statute, you know, for better or for worse, that I am not authorized to provide that body cam video to the press. The police can do so. And in Paul's case, I requested specifically of MPD that they provide the press with the video in a non-further redacted form. The police department is going to exercise its own discretion on that issue.
Apparently, they were ultimately able to get it by going to the U.S. Attorney's office.
Well, the U.S. Attorney's office in that case went to the court and asked the court for permission to release it to the press. We've not done so because we read the law pretty clearly as saying MPD is the decider of the release of body cam videos.
Did you get involved? Do you have a...
Got an email from Spencer about gun rights in D.C. Perhaps your guest can weigh in on the trampling of Second Amendment rights within the district.
Well, with respect, I obviously disagree with the guest. The Heller decision coming out of a D.C. circuit decision in 2008 made clear that the Constitution, actually for the first time, grants an individual the right to have a gun in their home. Jurisdictions throughout the country are trying now to figure out whether that Heller ruling extends beyond the home. In the District of Columbia, the legislators, you know, certainly evidencing the will of the people, have put on restrictions for the right to carry a concealed weapon in the District of Columbia. Those restrictions are currently being tested in the D.C. Circuit and will follow the law as announced by the circuit and by the Supreme Court in the future.
I want to ask about the gun because I keep thinking we should open a gun shop up on Capitol Hill so Congress can see the reality of a gun shop up there.
We only have about 2 minutes left.
Has Mayor Bowser been a good mayor?
Look, on that issue, I'm going to choose to answer it in the following way. When we at the Office of Attorney General have collaborated with Mayor Bowser on important issues, I think we've done right by the city together. I think it's important that leadership be collaborative. And I think some of the questions and some of the articles that have been published recently question the amount of collaboration between the mayor and the council. I want to say again, first, OAG has excellent relationships with every council member. And when we collaborate with the mayor, we do good things for the city.
That means when she reaches out to you, you work with her. You were involved very quickly.
1 minute.
Paid family leave. When I was down at the council, that was a chaotic day on Tuesday when this was all being passed, and the people weren't very excited. I was told then that you actually have physical concerns about paid family leave, although you support the program in general, and that you actually tried to call Robert White, the new council member, to urge him to vote against it and to vote for the substitute, which would have been less expensive. Didn't that, in fact, happen?
You've got good information, Tom. I can confirm that I certainly reached out to Councilman Robert White. I reached out to others as well. And to be sure, my concerns were not whether to go with the Jack Evans Shea bill versus, we'll call it, the Mendelson-Silverman bill. My concern was focusing more on what the council might do to close the gap of having D.C. tax revenue benefiting non-D.C. residents.
66% of the people who stand to benefit. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Carl Racine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
That's it for the show today and for the show in 2016. We're going to take a short break for the holidays next week, but we'll be back on the air and back in action on January 2nd. In the meantime, there's plenty at kojoshow.org that can keep you informed, entertained, and inspired over the holidays. You can check out our archives of past shows there, where you might want to listen to a conversation in which members of our staff reflected on a few of the local lives we lost during the past year. We hope you have a safe and happy holiday week with family and friends. Today is a significant one for all of us here. My friend Diane Rehm's show ended today. She encouraged me to take this job. I'm really glad I did. Plus, she's always had my back. Don't know who's going to protect me from Tom Sherwood now. Maybe Joshua Johnson, the host of the new 1A show. He's a big guy. But love and best wishes to Diane, who will be moving on to other duties at the station. We're looking forward to meeting you all back here in 2017. When we'll pick up our conversations about all of the things that make our region what it is. Until then, thank you all for listening and happy holidays. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Elizabeth Weinstein, Ruth Tam, and Avery Kleinman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.